let me introduce my first guest, or my only guest today, actually, Richard Mayberry. He's the editor of the investment newsletter U.S. and World Early Warning Report for Investors, and is the author of many books, including Precious Metals, Politics and Paper Money, Whatever Happened to Penny Candy, Whatever Happened to Justice, Ancient Rome, How It Affects You Today, The Thousand-Year War in the Middle East, and The Clipper Ship Strategy. He's the inventor of his own economic and political models, Chaos Stan and the New Axis Model, and has his own consumer pricing model called Mayberry's Complete Consumer Price Index, including government. Very interesting. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thanks, Scott. Glad to be here.
I'm very happy to have you on today. The first thing I want to get to here, your story to me is very interesting. As I understand it, you sort of started out on your own little crusade to save the world and then decided that it would be better to just go ahead and make money selling your knowledge as investment advice. Can you tell me a little bit about that story, how you got to where you are now?
Well, it wasn't actually a decision to start making money selling investment advice. What I eventually came to realize is that if you understand enough about geopolitics and economics, you can make money. And so my own little crusade kind of evolved into a symbiotic relationship with the investment industry, because I found that in talking about what was going on in the world, how the federal government was meddling in so many other countries and how these other countries were going to get revenge on us somehow, there were a lot of investment implications, and people would, ask me.
I'm sorry, we'll have to hold it right there as we go out to this first break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Richard Mayberry from the Early Warning Report. Friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm talking with Richard Mayberry from the Early Warning Report. And I'm sorry to give you such short shrift on your first answer there. So we're talking about your evolution of your study of history and economics into the position you're in now, giving investment advice to people.
Yeah, very, very quickly, I found out that by understanding what the federal government was doing in other countries, there were investment implications to that, as well as political and economic implications. And I just started making suggestions to people. They're doing such and such in this country. You might want to buy such and such a stock. And it was making money for people. And so I just continued doing that. And it works very nicely. An example would be when Bush went into Iraq more than 2 years ago now. I pointed out that they try to use technology as a substitute for troops because they don't want to go to a draft. They're really scared of a draft. So they keep inventing more and more electronic gadgets, and this requires the troops to carry more and more electronic gadgets, which need batteries. And the batteries have gotten to be a huge battlefield problem. The troops carry enormous quantities of these things, and they go through them tremendously. I suggested to people that when Bush invaded Iraq, I said, you might want to buy Ultralife batteries, which makes a lot of the military batteries. And Ultralife went up 500% from the military demand of the war in Iraq.
Is there a moral conflict there?
Beg pardon?
Is there a moral conflict there, cashing in off of warfare?
Well, I don't see anything wrong with it, as long as we're not doing anything to cause the war. If there's something that buying ultralight batteries would do to actually make the war happen, then sure, that would be a terrible thing to do, and I would advise against it. But as far as I can tell, buying for instance stocks in companies that sell things like that do not cause the war. Now, there are investment things that do help to cause the war. One of them would be buying treasury bills or treasury bonds, because when you're loaning money directly to the government, then you're providing it with the means to go out and attack other countries. So, you have situations where you can be implementing war policies, and I'd be against those. But as long as you're not doing something that induces a decision to attack somebody, then, you know, it's no different than selling plywood in an area that's had a hurricane or is going to have one. You know, somebody's got to provide the plywood, and somebody's going to make a profit doing that. The life is full of misfortunate things, so that's the way it is.
Well, in my researching of your story, it seems like you've made a lot of really accurate predictions about events in global politics over the last 20 years. The fall of the Berlin Wall, the 87 stock market crash, the Iraq-Kuwait conflict over the oil patch down there in the border region, the importance of Al-Qaeda as far back as when bin Laden first issued his fatwa in 96. And I wonder, what's your trick to getting so many predictions correct?
Well, I, you know, as a kind of a hobby, really early on, you're going back like 30 years or more, I studied law quite a bit, and especially the history of law, and came up with the fact that the early British common law was based on two fundamental principles that are taught by all religions. The first one is do all you have agreed to do. That was the basis of contract law. And the other one was do not encroach on other persons or their property, which was the basis of tort law and some criminal law. And that's the fundamental part of my model. I just took those two laws and said, well, wherever the U.S. government is violating these two laws, things are probably going to get worse. Something bad is going to happen. And so I use those two laws to look at the federal government's foreign policy all around the world. And when I see it violating one of those two laws, I figure, oh, okay, now let's try to figure out what the results are going to be. And so it's very simple. It goes straight back to the old British common law, which was based on religious principles that are commonly taught by all religions. And it works.
What role does Austrian economics play in your model?
Well, the Austrian economists, they're called Austrian because the originators back 100 years or so ago were from Austria. And the Austrian economists see the, or one thing that makes them different is that they see the economy as human behavior, not as a machine. They don't regard it as something you can fine-tune. To an Austrian economist, the economy is an ecology. It's not some easily manipulated group of gears and levers that we can pull to make things go in some specific direction. So Austrian economics is the school of economics that agrees most closely with those two laws that are taught by all religions, because the two laws acknowledge that human beings have a free will, and so does Austrian economics. There's a lot of attention in Austrian economics to the fact that humans have free wills and they can change their minds, and that's one of the main reasons governments cannot manipulate economies to are very, very effectively, because people have free wills and they go off in directions that the politicians never thought they would. And so the Austrian economics kind of dovetails perfectly with my political model, which is based on those two laws.
You've written that 1776 was the all-important year, that humankind had basically had a more or less constant standard of living for a few thousand years. Until about 1776, we saw exponential growth in wealth on the part of the average person. What's the key there?
Well, the let's see.
Take your time.
Words or less, right?
Take your time until I cut you off for the next commercial.
Okay. What was going on in England was that England was an island. And because it was an island, it was a place that was very easy to evade the government's taxes and controls. There was some comment I remember being made that England was an island entirely surrounded by smugglers or something to that effect. And the British were very vigorously evading the government's taxes and controls. And when naval technology advanced to the point where you could get across the Atlantic Ocean without dying in a storm or something, a lot of Englishmen started leaving England, coming to America, and that's where they founded the American colonies. And they took these two common law principles with them. And the early colonies were a place where tax evasion and smuggling were the economy. I mean, everybody was involved in tax evasion and smuggling. And they obeyed those two fundamental laws probably more diligently than any other culture that's ever existed.
And again, those two laws are you keep your promises and you respect other people's property rights.
Well, life, liberty, and property. The way I like to say them is, do all you have agreed to do, and do not encroach on other persons or their property. The inhabitants of the colonies followed those two laws very closely, but they just ignored political law altogether. And so the U.S., or not U.S., the American economy before 1776 was probably the freest in the world, and the Americans were probably the most prosperous population in the world. And then the revolution broke out, and the colonists won, and they created the Declaration of Independence and Bill of Rights, Constitution, that were fundamentally based on those two laws. And this produced this explosion of prosperity in America that was observed by people in other countries, and people in other countries wanted to be prosperous too, and so they started trying to copy the Americans, and the political system the Americans had invented began spreading around the world, and the places where it came to become well established are what used to be called the free world, and those countries were also the most prosperous. And you have wherever there's some degree of copying of the American system, you have a tremendously prosperous population, people who have very good incomes compared to the places where they still have dictatorships and other more primitive forms of political systems, which is the type we're trending toward now in America pretty quickly, and we'll probably lose the benefits of the 1776 system when we do.
Well, now, when we're talking about, this is basically the English Enlightenment. When you say life, liberty, and property, we're talking about John Locke and Thomas Jefferson.
Right.
Here. So, now, I think I've read somewhere where you've written that basically the ideas of John Locke were spreading across Europe, but they ran into a brick wall, and that somehow the English Enlightenment ideas of individualism and property rights never crossed this barrier. What was that barrier?
What happened was in the mid-1800s, you had socialism revived. Socialism actually was the economic system of the Roman Empire back, 15 centuries ago. And in the mid-1800s, along came Marx and his followers, and they revived this Roman system. And that killed off the spread of the Enlightenment, these English Enlightenment ideas. And it got, the English ideas got to about Poland or so. And
all right, we'll be right back, everybody, with Richard Mayberry. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. Did I mention also I write for antiwar.com? You can look up my archives there. I'm talking with Richard Mayberry from the Early Warning Report. His website is chaosstan.com. And when we went out to the break, we're talking about how the ideals of individual liberty, free markets, you had the John Locke's ideas, and then in the same year you had the Declaration of Independence and Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, and you have laissez-faire economics and principles of individual liberty, and they're spreading like wildfire across Europe. And then, according to Richard Mayberry, they hit this brick wall called socialism, which was still liberalism, right? It was a rejection of superstition and religion and kings and the old ways. It was still liberalism, but instead of being individualism and property rights and laissez-faire, it now became collectivism and statism and basically slavery. And so, if I read you right, Mr. Mayberry, what you call Chaosstan is all of that land east of Germany and Poland where the ideals of John Locke never spread.
That's right. Those ideas did kind of leak to a very small extent as far into the east as Moscow. And there was a little bit of, kind of a flavor of them in the Russian Revolution. But basically, they got as far as Germany, and they started really petering out a lot. And so the area from Poland to the Pacific and the Arctic Ocean to the Indian Ocean, plus North Africa, is what I call Chaosstan, which means the land of the great chaos. And if you look at history, you'll find that most of the warfare and the poverty and every other kind of human misery you can imagine has happened in that area that I call Chaosstan. It's Poland to the Pacific, Arctic Ocean to the Indian Ocean, and North Africa. Those are the areas that it's just been war after war, bloodshed endlessly since the beginning of time, because they never got any kind of an alternative system that would work against that. And that can, we can segue then into U.S. foreign policy today, which is that the U.S. government is over there trying to, get involved and clean that place up.
I mean, you can't even say it with a straight face, can you?
No, it is so absolutely insane. And I would like to blow my own horn here a little bit by saying I was predicting all of this since 1981. That's when I wrote a 25-page report called The Thousand-Year War, and that eventually became a book that you mentioned earlier in 1999. And I was explaining it. This part of the world is inherently chaotic because they do not have any heritage of those legal principles or legal systems built on those principles that I was explaining earlier. And so just stay away from it. Don't meddle in that area. Just get as far away from it as you can, because nothing good is going to happen there.
But Richard, George Bush in his inaugural speech said that liberty here depends on liberty around the world, and that if we can just spread democracy and liberty through the Middle East, then we can all get along. We can end this thousand-year war by making them like us.
So we're going to take the U.S. government, which is the largest, most powerful, one of the most frightening organizations ever to be seen on Earth, and they're going to spread liberty, right? Uh-huh.
But I thought, is America not a synonym for liberty?
America may be. The U.S. government, though, is not America. That's a really important point that people forget, is the government is not the country. The country, is the most wonderful place in the world. I live here. I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. America is fantastic. But the government, oh, my God, it's one of the worst scourges the world has ever seen. And this idea that it's going to spread liberty is ridiculous. You might as well ask Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin to spread liberty. The U.S. government would do just about as good a job as they would.
In fact, you make the point about the difference between the French Revolution and the American Revolution, where the American revolutionaries said, see, we did it right. Now, everybody, you ought to be like us. And where the French Revolution said, see, we did it right. Now, we're going to force all of you to be like us and export our revolution. And I guess, as you pointed out before, we're trying to export American principles that we don't even have anymore. We've basically socialized out the last of our libertarian principles here in America, and at the same time, we're trying to spread them overseas.
Yeah, this idea that democracy is a good thing, and that we have to shed American blood to spread democracy, that is crazy. I've read an awful lot of the literature of the American Revolution. I've never seen the word democracy. They were not fighting for democracy. They were fighting for liberty, which is something entirely different. the U.S. government is over there in the Mideast trying to give these people majority rule. Well, you know, if you're a minority and somebody's threatening to give you majority rule, you're going to be scared out of your mind. And that's exactly what's happening in Iraq. It's why the Sunnis, who are a minority, are fighting so hard, because they're scared to death of living under the majority Shiites. And if I were them, I would be too.
All right, everybody, it's the Weekend Interview Show, and I'm talking with Richard J. Mayberry from the Early Warning Report. Look him up at chaosstan.com. We'll be right back. Alright, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Keep all the archives for you there in MP3 format, including last Saturday's groundbreaking interview with Sabelle Edmonds, the FBI translator whistleblower. The transcript of that interview will be up on antiwar.com Monday, I believe. But the MP3 is available for you there at weekendinterviewshow.com. I'm talking with Richard Mayberry from the Early Warning Report. I want to get to this thousand-year war in the Middle East. You've written that the American people might not have any idea, but to the Muslim world, this is just another crusade in a long line of crusades.
That's right. you can trace this whole thing from, let's say, Muhammad the 7th century?
I think so, 700s.
Yeah. Muhammad came along, and he was a pretty fierce character, and there was a lot of Arab-Muslim attacks on Europeans for the first 100 years or so during the Middle Ages there, and then that died out. The Muslims kind of decided that they'd much rather be lovers than fighters, and the Arab-Muslim Golden Age began, and you have about a 200 to 300 year period where almost all of the fighting between the Islamic world and the Christian world in Europe died out. There were some brief skirmishes here and there, but basically they were getting along okay. In terms of the times, it was, you know, it was like paradise. It was really a pretty amicable situation. And then along came the Crusaders around the year 1000, and they decided, hey, it would be a good idea to start fighting the Muslims again. And so this series of wars was revived, and around 1100 AD, they launched into the full-blown crusade. And so I've always referred to it as the Thousand-Year War, because it was the Europeans who brought an end to the period of relative peace and launched the early attacks, which then evolved into the crusades. And it's never ended since. A very important statistic is that since the year 1500, there's hardly been any five-year period in which European troops have not been under arms on Muslim soil. Now, the final Muslim invasion of Europe ended in Vienna around 1683, so it's been entirely the Europeans, who are Christians, you know, just pounding the bejesus out of the Muslims for more than three centuries.
Well, George Bush said this morning, in fact, that we're fighting them over there, so we don't have to fight them over here.
Yeah, that's what they told me when I was in Vietnam, too.
The North Vietnamese were going to invade the West Coast, is that it?
Yeah, right. I mean, there were some people who laughed about it then, but basically the American population bought that line during the Vietnam War, and I did too. I believe we had to go fight the Vietnamese on the other side of the world, because they might, if we didn't get them there, you know, they might strap their AK-47s on their backs and swim across the Pacific and invade us.
Now, when you talk about this thousand-year war in the Middle East, I think the war party would probably at least try to latch on to some of your argument and say that, hey, you know, this has been going on for 1,000 years. That just proves what a dangerous, incompatible religion Islam is, and maybe use your argument to justify more warfare. What would you say to that?
Well, I hear that a lot, and you know, it's for sure that Islam doesn't have a clean slate, but neither does Christianity. And if you would, I mean, you know, if you want to get brutally frank here, if you want to really be honest about your statistics, what you do is you start doing a body count, and you look at the Christian cultures, and you look at the number of innocent people who have been murdered in the Christian cultures, and then you look at the number who have been murdered in the Islamic cultures, and any other culture you want to bring up, Buddhist, Hindu, Shinto, all of them. Let's just lay out the body counts here and see who's got the most horrible body count. And let me tell you, the Christians win hands down. They're way out ahead of anybody else when it comes to murdering innocent people. So, and I have actually done the statistics, so I know what I'm talking about there.
Well, and it also sort of, when you bring up the statistic that the last Arab army left Vienna in 1600-something, it's pretty hard to argue that.
Right.
And I think you said, what was it, there hasn't been a five-year period without European troops in the Middle East, is that what you said?
Yeah, it's almost impossible to find a five-year period in the last 500 years in which European Christian troops have not been under arms on Muslim soil. And you can actually verify that yourself. Our listeners can pretty easily get a copy of the World Almanac from a library or buy one at a bookstore and look at the histories of the countries in the Mideast. And just go, you can page, you know, one page after the other. You just take a look at these little histories they have in there. And you'll find that in the World Almanac, I would say almost every country in the Islamic world had a period of European domination. It was the Europeans who were kicking the bejesus out of them, in many cases for many centuries.
Well, shouldn't the United States be innocent in all this? At what point does all this guilt shift to across the ocean to North America?
In the Marine Corps hymn, you know, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli.
So it was Thomas Jefferson himself who did it.
Yeah, yeah. Nobody admires Jefferson more than I do, but he got suckered into fighting the Europeans' war for them. The Barbary Wars, which were going on 200 years ago, were simply an extension of the Crusades. They were another chapter in the Crusades. And the Muslims and the Christians were fighting for control of the Mediterranean. And Jefferson allowed himself to be suckered into fighting the Europeans' war for them. And that's what the line from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli refers to. Tripoli is in Libya. And, in fact, it was back in the 80s, you might remember, that Ronald Reagan was fighting with Gaddafi over exactly the same patch of water that the Americans under Jefferson were fighting 200 years earlier. So it was 200 years ago at Tripoli that the Americans entered the war on the side of the Europeans.
And when was the next time the United States intervened in the Middle East after that?
I don't know if I can give you the exact next time. There actually wasn't a whole lot of U.S. Intervention after that. And then in the 20th century, it really got hot and heavy, especially after World War II. That's where it kind of became irreversible. In the 1940s, the U.S. government climbed into bed with the Saudi royal family. And the Saudi royal family are not a bunch of choir boys. And then they went on to interfere in the politics of Iran. And basically, the British government had been running the Persian Gulf for, you know, I don't know, maybe a century or more. And it was the U.S. in the 1940s that stepped in and took Britain's place and began backing all these cutthroats that controlled the area because those cutthroats had oil under their land. And that's really where the stage was set for the modern, or this latest chapter in the Crusades that we're fighting today. It was in the 1940s, this backing of these dictators in the Persian Gulf the attempt to... getting involved in the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran in the early 1950s. That's where it all started. And the real, I count the Muslim counterattack against that U.S. intervention that began in the 40s. I count that as 1968 when Sirhan Sirhan killed Robert Kennedy. I think that was the beginning of the war we are presently in, is when Sirhan Sirhan killed Kennedy because Kennedy was expressing an intention to get more deeply involved in the Mideast.
But you do point out that approximately 85% or 75% of the world's oil reserves are in that part of the Middle East. So do we not need military force to get that oil?
I think what we need is money. Those people like money. And if you offer to buy their oil from them, they're going to sell it. Now, I don't know who is going to sell it to us. The war that Bush has started there is likely to spread throughout the Persian Gulf, and we don't know who's going to wind up owning the place when it's all over with. So we'll be able to buy the oil from somebody who owns it, but you know who that's going to be, there's just no way to know. But, and it's always been that case, that way. I mean, you know, if you've got a whole lot of oil under your land, well, what do you do with it? What good is it? Do you drink it? No, you've got to sell it.
You know, that's exactly what bin Laden himself said. What are we going to do with it? Drink it? Of course we'll sell
right?
you our oil. Yeah, that was exactly what he said.
I didn't know that.
And, you know, not like he'd be the one in charge anyway, but still, if Osama bin Laden is willing to sell us the oil, assuming he controlled it, then it's a pretty safe bet we could probably do business with whoever was running things over there.
Sure. You know, money really talks, and the idea that the people who own the oil, or let's say control the oil over there now, are a bunch of nice guys, that's ridiculous. Those are a bunch of cutthroat dictators who were put in power by the British for the convenience of the British. And you know, they are, they're nobody you would want to marry your sister, believe me. So, you know, bin Laden takes over, or someone else, he isn't likely to be any worse than the people who are already there.
Yeah, our allies, the people that we support.
Right.
Like
right.
Mubarak.
Yep.
Tell me, what's the new axis?
Back in 1996, I think it was, I began to notice that there was an alliance developing among Washington's enemies. And I started making a list of these enemies and tracking their behavior, and came up with a theory that they actually were working together in concert to try to sucker the U.S. into a war in the Islamic world, a guerrilla war in the Islamic world. And I called that group the New Axis, because the Germany, Italy, Japan axis in World War II, you know, this then I called the New Axis. So it's just a kind of a play on the World War II terminology. And the newsletter early warning report reports on the new axis occasionally, and sometimes I'll point out that the idea that the U.S. Troops are sent into Iraq and Afghanistan just to fight the forces there is extremely naive, that this is a big opportunity for the new axis to humiliate the U.S., and that they are probably all in one way or another helping the guerrillas that American troops are being sent to fight. And as time goes on, the evidence crops up that that is the case. You might have noticed a week or two ago that, somebody asked Rumsfeld, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, about some explosives that have been found in the bombs in Iraq that are used on American troops, that the explosives appear to have originated in Iran. And Rumsfeld, I said it probably is the case that stuff is coming in. I think probably a lot of stuff is coming in, as well as a lot of trainers to train the Iraqis.
Well, and we know now that Ahmed Chalabi was basically working for Iran, in part. Some of the lies that they used to lure us into the war in Iraq came from Iran through their agent Chalabi.
That's right. Yeah, one of the points I've made over the years, maybe I should do another article on this.
Well, in fact, hang on one sec. Let me stop you right there, because I know that there's at least somebody within the sound of my voice is saying, so then you're proposing war against Iran and Russia and all these people who are our enemies then, right?
No, absolutely not. We're losing the one we're in right now. If you widen it, we're just going to lose it even worse. It's a guerrilla war, and Americans don't fight guerrilla wars very easily or very well.
Do you have any personal experience with that topic?
Yeah, when I was in the Air Force, I was in the 605th Air Commando Squadron, and our job was anti-guerrilla warfare, and so I kind of learned firsthand what Americans are not able to do. What you have to do to win a guerrilla war is you've got to wipe out the whole population in which the guerrillas are hiding. You've got to be an Adolf Hitler, and Americans don't like doing that. the American troops just go through this tremendous psychological wrenching that just destroys them ethically and emotionally when they have to go into a village and wipe the whole thing out. And so Americans are very bad at guerrilla war, and the other side knows that. And that's been my point for more than 10 years, is they know that guerrilla war is our Achilles heel, and so they're going to try to sucker us into a guerrilla war.
Bin Laden calls it the bleed until bankruptcy plan.
Yeah, that's a big part of it, no doubt about it. Where were we? Oh, we were talking about the new Axis. I think that I think the Russians are in on this. Now, not necessarily the Kremlin itself. I don't know if Putin is in on it. But I would imagine there are a lot of groups in Russia that are smuggling weapons and whatever else they can into Iraq. Probably the Chinese. There are Chinese groups that are in on it. Iranian, for sure. The U.S. is in there fighting a lot more people than the ones that Washington admits to.
Are you familiar with the works of William S. Lind?
I don't think so.
I think you and he are just two peas in a pod. If you go to antiwar.com, you can find the archives of William S. Lind. He's from the Free Congress Foundation. And his whole thing is about, right along the lines you're saying about guerrilla warfare, he calls it fourth generation warfare, which is sort of back to before the Treaty of Westphalia, when it's just private armies running around doing what they want. Generation negative one, you could call it, I guess. And he's basically come to the same conclusion as you, that the U.S. military cannot win against fourth generation warfare, and that the best offense is a really good defense and no offense.
Right. I'm a great advocate of the Swiss system. If people are really interested in a military system that actually does work, that preserves peace and liberty without turning you into a slave, they should study the Swiss system while it still exists. The Swiss are slowly dismantling it. But in Switzerland, essentially every able-bodied male between the ages of 20 and 50 is a member of the militia, and he keeps his battle rifle and his ammunition in his home. He's very well trained. He goes for annual training. And Switzerland has been at peace for it's around 200 years. They did not get involved in either World War I or World War II, even though they were entirely surrounded by those wars. Nobody attacked Switzerland because the Swiss militia was so powerful, even though it's a very tiny country.
Right, and because they don't attack anyone for anybody to need revenge against them.
That's right.
We'll be right back after this break, everybody. We're talking with Richard Mayberry, ChaosStand.com. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm having such a good time talking with Richard Mayberry from the Early Warning Report. And the only problem is we've got about 6 minutes left and the show's going to be over, and I only have about two or three more pages full of questions, unfortunately. So I could take this a bunch of different directions. I think what's most important here probably for the listeners is I want to know about your Uncle Eric books that you write for the teenagers. What's going on with that?
Oh, well, as someone who was listening earlier in the hour probably gathered, I believe that there's really no solution to America's problems until we revive an understanding of what this country is supposed to be all about. The things that I was talking about earlier, the two fundamental laws that make civilization possible, do all you have agreed to do and do not encroach on other persons or their property, and the common law and the free market economics, all of this has basically been washed out of the schools altogether because the schools are all owned or controlled by government agencies. And so the kids never are exposed to the real American heritage while they're in school. Some brilliant politician in the past figured out that if the government controls the schools, it doesn't need to control the press. And so, we all come out of school these days just being absolutely dedicated statists because that's what we were taught in school. And so the Uncle Eric books are a series of 12 books that are written by an economist to his niece or nephew And he's just sitting down and he's saying, okay, this is what you didn't get in school. And it's written in a very simple, straightforward way that any teenager should be able to understand. And, of course, most of the books are read by adults, actually.
Yeah, they're great for adults. I read the World War One, and my friend Anthony Gregory, he read the World War Two, and we both had a great time reading those books.
Yeah, thank you, thank you. Those are two examples. We've just been deluged by the U.S. government's view on World War One and World War Two, and we see the present war through that prism that we are taught, and we all just kind of assume that the government's view of World War One and World War Two is correct, and then we kind of transplant that model onto the present war. And what those two books do is try to show people, well, here's another side of the story. This is what you don't know about World War One and World War Two. I've had that comment from numerous people that they never dreamed that all these things happened in World War One and World War Two. And that the picture of the war that they've been given by the U.S. government and by the Hollywood movies is so misleading, it's astounding.
How much do you have to do with the homeschooling movement besides just writing material for it?
Well, the homeschool movement is kind of my hope for what's going to solve the problem. The statistics seem to show that there are better than a million families out there now that homeschool their kids. And those people are able to teach their kids something other than statism. And so my books are used quite a bit in the homeschool movement as an alternative to the statist material that kids get elsewhere. And they're pretty popular, and my hope is that the homeschool movement continues to grow, and, of course, that my books are used there.
All right, everybody. Richard Mayberry, he's the author of the Early Warning Report for Investors. You can look up his website at chaosstan.com. That's chaosstan.com. And really brilliant stuff, everybody. Please check out Richard Mayberry. Thank you so much for your time today, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, everybody. Check out my writings at antiwar.com. And new time starting next week, 7 to 9 o'clock Texas time for the weekend interview show. We'll talk to you then.